Welcome to another Rick and Rob Sports Show. I'm Robert Laidler.
And I'm Rick Drewer.
The first week of March has been interesting cricket-wise, locally and statewide. First off, in the last minor round game of the Boston Light A-grade cricket, Sandy Creek got up to beat top team Angaston, and those two teams will finish 1-2. But there's one kid for Sandy Creek, the Cockatoos, Jamie Diner. He was the opening batsman, and he got 173 runs, but interestingly, it was made up of 21 sixes and 3 fours. 21 sixes out of his 173 is 73% of his score. That's amazing. What do you think of that, Rick?
That's some big hitting, obviously. He obviously enjoys chasing and hitting the ball very hard.
He ended up getting out LBW, so obviously you take your risk when you hit sixes.
Oh, you do. And I guess if you play that style of game, which he obviously had to do, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. This time it obviously worked very well for him.
Absolutely. And in week one, the Angaston scored something like 288 runs, and Sandy Creek responded with 328. Obviously, they just keep batting in those two-day games.
They do indeed. Yes, that's the way it works.
So to hit that many sixes, you know, and out of the percentage of your score, that's sort of like, would be close to a record. I think there's a few other people that have hit 20, 21 type sixes, but out of the percentage of your score, 73%, that's almost unheard of.
Well, yes. I mean, I haven't got the stats with me, but you look at some of the fastest innings in Test cricket, I guess there'd be a number of them around that mark, but I really won't. I don't know where it would actually stand.
He actually got his century in the opening session too, which is quite impressive. And he was there was a couple of ones where he got some lucky calls that went his way, but the cricket's like that.
Well, of course, cricket's like that. You've only got to look at the Test match in New Zealand, and some wrong decisions are happening. Who knows whether they are right, wrong, or indifferent? But I guess the reality is that the umpires are there to make a decision, and if they're given not out, they're not out.
Yes, and also locally, they had the Championship Cup for the Metro teams and for 2020, and Virginia were up against Keswick. Now, there's a $1,500 prize for the winner, so and it's played at Adelaide Oval, so there's a lot there riding on the end of those types of games.
Yes, well, from what I understand, that it was a very even teams on paper, but in fact the result of the final was quite a one-sided affair.
Well, Virginia batted first, and they lost four really quick wickets, and they looked like they're in mountains of trouble. And then Sean Lay, who used to play for South Gawler, he's now at Virginia, he got 77 not out, which was 66% of their score, 7 for 116. That's a pretty good knock, 77, especially when you've lost four early wickets.
It is indeed. It's one of the it's one of the characteristics, I guess, of 2020 cricket, where collapses can occur, but if you're lucky enough or good enough to have one or two batsmen who are in form on the day, because it's only a 2020 game, they can have an incredible influence on the score they make and thus the result that comes about.
Now, we were talking about Virginia surviving that mini collapse at the start. Keswick crumbled to be all out for 38. That's just obviously a lot of pressure.
Huge pressure. And again, it's the same old story that, you know, I guess unless somebody for Virginia had come in and made that 70-odd, they crumbled as well. But they were fortunate enough to have one or two players that got a start. And that's the thing in 2020 cricket. Or you're going to look very foolish and be out for 30 or 40 because no one gets a start. They're all getting threes and fours or whatever and then getting out.
Well, in this game, the bowlers that did well for Virginia is John Natsios got 4 for 2 and Nathan Warren got 3 for 4. That's like 7 wickets for 6 runs.
Yes, that's quite staggering. Again, without being negative, you just don't quite know whether many of those wickets came about from great delivery beating batsmen or batsmen, putting it bluntly, slogging and throwing their wicket away.
Now, on this show, a couple of times we've talked about Travis Head, who's a local lad, He did the job for South Australia in an exciting win against Western Australia in the Sheffield Shield clash in Perth this week.
He certainly did. Travis Head, basically won the game. There's no question about that, by making a magnificent 134 off of not too many more deliveries than that.
139.
Yep. Now, that's amazing. So it's obvious that he was put into a position where, because wickets had fallen, he played it as a one-day game. And he really had no choice in that because it wasn't as if he had batsmen about to come out or surround him. And he, I'm not saying he got lucky, but he hits the ball beautifully when he's hitting the ball. And he got, after they were in fact, I think they were 6 for 174, chasing 274 to win. Now, he was joined by Joe Meny after Carey was out, and they were cruising. They'd got to 250, still with only six wickets down. And there they are, needing 24 more to win. And the sad thing is that Travis decided to play, literally a slog and get out when there were only 24 needed with half a day's play. And thus put South Australia from having been in a poor position to being in virtually an unbeatable position. All of a sudden, there were only Sayers, Worrell, and, dare I say, an injured batsman who didn't actually bat in the first innings, Nick Benton, because he'd dislocated his shoulder in a fielding accident in the first innings. And having gone from the comfortable position, in fact, Sayers was out for three and Worrell was out for naught, and Nick Benton was forced to put the pads on, I guess, with some help, given that he'd had a dislocated shoulder, and had to come out to bat to join Joe Meny with still seven runs required for victory. End of story, they got them. A couple of thick edges, including the four that won the game, off of Nick Benton's bat. But it was an incredibly courageous thing for an injured player, particularly a shoulder, which not only makes you virtually in a sport like cricket unable to do all the actions that are required, and to even front up was a wonderful performance. So you could almost say that Travis Head won the game for us and then nearly lost the game for us by getting out when he did. But a win is a win, and it still keeps their hopes alive.
Yeah, the story about Travis obviously is always good news for local northern people because he's a local lad. But the story about dislocating your shoulder and sort of coming back in, those inspiring stories are the ones that they talk about in 20, 30 years' time.
They are indeed. And it was an incredibly courageous thing to do. There has been scattered throughout cricket history the odd player who's had to come out and do something with some of the test players with broken jaws or whatever, but this was an emergency. He decided without question that he was going to do it and got the job done.
With cricket sort of coming to its concluding stages and finals over the next couple of weeks, one thing good about the Pulasalai and the Gawler type of area is the football usually starts after the grand final, so there's a clear definition in regards to the football and cricket seasons, which traditionally is the way it's always been in even the SNFL and district cricket and everything. But nowadays, football and to a lesser degree soccer seem to impinge on the cricket season, and it makes it very difficult for people to play both sports.
It certainly does. I think the big problem is that football has encroached upon, or all codes of football have encroached upon the particularly cricket. And cricket and football codes have virtually sided together financially because cricket, putting it bluntly, needs the support and help of football codes almost to survive. And I think the sad truth of the matter is that is shown up very clearly in that three of the major sporting arenas of Australia, that is Adelaide Oval, the MCG and the Sydney Cricket Ground, aren't available for playing a Sheffield Shield final which obviously depends on who the two teams are in the final, simply because they've been handed over, in the case of Adelaide Oval and the MCG, to Australian football, and in the case of Sydney, also Australian football, and even the Olympic Stadium is basically controlled by rugby as well. And so the final, no matter where who it's between, is going to be played at what I guess we'd suggest is a second class arena, simply because the other first class arenas aren't available.
You know, in the early years, in the 1960s and 70s, so many people played both sports at the top level. There was John Halbert, who got the equivalent of the Bradman Medal and the McGilley Medal. There was Barry Robwin, he played state cricket and, of course, won 3 McGilley Medals. Eric Freeman was a sensational cricketer and footballer. Then going through the 80s and 90s, it dwindled. There was a couple of people. The last person to get a Redbacks contract with the Future in Cricket and picked up by the AFL was Shannon Hearn. Nowadays, it's almost unheard of.
It certainly is. And a classic example of the state that it's in is this fellow Alex Keith, who's come over to South Australia. He's played a handful of first-class cricket matches for Victoria, and his chosen sport is cricket ahead of football, and he's done very well in his first year over here in Premier League and has made a number of centuries for prospect, and in fact was given the last position in the strikers group. He didn't actually play a game, but nevertheless he was listed and collected $20,000 for doing so. The Crows took a gamble and put him on the rookies list in the hope that he would give up cricket to play football. But because he's done so very well, there's a speculation that he will be offered a Redbacks and a Strikers position after the season's over, which would necessitate that he can't play football for the Crows. But I guess time will tell.
Yeah, I remember back in the old days, it used to be with baseball and cricket, and baseball was played in the winter and cricket was played in the summer, and a lot of players used baseball as practice for cricket. And then even when they initiated the night baseball league, you still had your Greg Chappells and Ian Chappells, and all these cricketers who played for Australia were still playing baseball, but you don't hear much of that nowadays. So I suppose the world turns when you talk about various different sports.
Oh, it does indeed. In my era, the baseballer who was a very, very good cricketer and very quick bowler was David Mundy. He could play both because of what you've just said, but that wouldn't happen now.
No, and it's interesting, over the years, the way football has become big business, there's a focus and the money is on those sports. And as a consequence of that, there seems to be a lot of infiltration at the Auskick level, and it's all about the dreams about playing footy, whereas in the old days it was traditionally footy and cricket.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole thing is that, of course, because of the physical demands on the codes of football, whether it's AFL, rugby league, rugby union or soccer, that they are professional sportsmen. And whereas there used to be in the old days the proverbial season break between seasons, that is winter and summer, now they get about 6 weeks after the footy seasons. They're training again before Christmas.
Yes, and the training, of course, impinges on the cricket training, so that's probably the main reason. They might go out and play a little bit of social cricket, but they never seem to be available for finals because of the football commitments. It's just a whole range of different things. But one of the interesting things is with AFL, you can't really represent Australia except for that Irish game, yet cricket, we're getting the bag of green is quite enticing. So it is a little bit surprising that more people tend to go to AFL than what they do to cricket.
Yes, I guess it's surprising and yet not surprising that for the average good sportsman, there's far more money to be earned in AFL than there is in cricket. Now, sure, if you reach the top echelons in cricket, there is huge money to be earned. But given the number of teams, the number of positions in a team, or the number of positions in a squad, it's far more difficult to reach the top in cricket than it is in football, simply due to the number of states playing as against the number of teams, for example, in the AFL. And so I think that's probably part of the reason. Going back to your earlier comment about being able to mix the two sports, again, in my era, two very famous Victorians who had to choose in the end were Max Walker and Paul Sheehan, both very, very good cricketers and footballers. And in fact, I had the privilege of even staying in Paul Sheehan's house when I was captain of the school football team and he was captain of his, and we played a game in Victoria and we were billeted there. But in the end, Paul decided he was obviously a very good cricketer as well, and he took his chances in cricket and proved to be very successful, as did Max Walker, who used to play league football for Melbourne.
I think there was a different scenario back then in regards to the financial incentive to play sort of VFL football. It wasn't anywhere near what it is today.
Oh, absolutely correct. And the physical training demands were so different to today, where the fitness levels simply weren't as strenuous and as high as they are now. And so you could afford to have, as it were, a break from football and be playing cricket. Whereas now, as I said earlier, you've got 6 weeks break and a holiday and then you're back into it again before Christmas.
And of course, back in the 70s and the 60s and those types of periods where people were playing the two sports, even the demands in season for football, you know, weren't anywhere near what they are. They train like Tuesday nights and Thursday nights and Sunday mornings and play Saturday afternoon.
That's right, and if they were a bit lucky, they'd have a pie and a beer after Thursday night's training.
And some even had the smoko at three-quarter time.
Well, they did indeed. I can remember the vision with the great Malcolm Blight in one of those preliminary finals, I think it was, where they tied and the cameras went in there and the first thing you see is him with a cigarette in his mouth.
Yes, it is a different game today.
Totally different world.
Totally different. So in the end, I perhaps miss the way that sports people can play the different sports and they're all associated with one sport. I probably prefer the older ways. What about you? What's your view?
Look, I think it's simple to put it this way. I'm fascinated by the advice given to all of these professional sportsmen these days: go out and have some fun. Well, the fact is they don't have fun because it is so serious, it is so professional, whereas everyone wanted to still win and be competitive back in the older days, but the fact is they did have fun because the demands weren't as high, the rules weren't as strict, and it was fun, whereas I don't think at the top echelons of any sport today it's fun, it's more like business.
Now that ends today's show, but one of the things that Rick and I will be looking at in the coming shows will be some of the music associated with sport. So stand ready for that, and if anyone's got any opinions on their favourite music with sport, whether it's football, cricket, or just general music that they play at sport events, by all means, let us know and we'll try to include it. This is the Rick and Rob Show. I'm Robert Laidlaw.
And I'm Rick Drew.